It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, saving language. You know about endangered species, maybe donated money to save whales or polar bears, but there's an even bigger extinction crisis facing us. The world's languages are dying. In fact, according to some estimates, we lose a language every 2 weeks or so. Luckily, there are people like David Harrison, a linguist who's traveled to some of the most remote places on the planet looking for lost languages. Kind of like Indiana Jones. Steve Paulson tracked him down.
David, why are so many languages going extinct?
In a word, you could say globalization, the forces of industrialization, urbanization. But there's a more important pressure, and that is small languages are disadvantaged, they're disfavored. It's partly because those of us who speak major languages don't really appreciate the knowledge base that is found in small languages. And so the speakers of those languages, eventually they internalize those negative attitudes and they start to devalue their own languages. And you're losing a whole set of knowledge, tradition, history, mythology, wisdom that simply cannot be directly translated or transferred over into English.
So this is more than just saving words. I mean, you're talking about saving a way of life, a whole body of knowledge.
It's an immense body of knowledge. It's scientific knowledge. It's cultural knowledge. You know, we maybe think that we know everything we need to know and that we can Google everything or look everything up. But I've had the privilege of walking through the Australian outback with elders. I've walked through the Siberian forests with elders. And the knowledge they have is just astounding of those ecosystems. We would die there in a day or two. They thrive in those harsh environments because they know every plant and animal and the interactions. And that knowledge doesn't exist in English. It's not known to Western science. It's local knowledge. It's indigenous knowledge.
Well, in fact, I've heard one story that is in that the Arctic people, the Yupik, they have something like 99 distinct types of sea ice formations.
Yes, because the Yupik who live in Alaska devote a great deal of their time to simply observing the ice. It's a major pastime or avocation, and it's crucial to their livelihood. They have well documented their 99 different words for different types of sea ice formations. And so that's a nice example of local knowledge that's very complex. It's much more detailed than what, say, a meteorologist would know about sea ice.
Well, and I would think as we enter the age of global warming and ice starting to disappear, actually that kind of local knowledge could be incredibly useful to study what's happening.
It literally could save us. And so this is another reason not to dismiss or discount indigenous languages as quaint or obsolete. They have ancient knowledge. They have very deep knowledge. It's their intellectual property. Their cultural wealth, and we could all benefit from having this knowledge be preserved.
And then there are these small ways that, as I was reading about your research, sort of individual words that say so much. I mean, for instance, I guess there's a single Tuvan word that means the short side of the hill.
Yeah, the word e, which I really loved. Tuvan has all kinds of wonderful complexities, but they really care about the landscape. And so every minute feature on the landscape is named and described in the language. And so E is a very useful concept because when you're out in this landscape, which has almost no trees, but lots of hills, and you might be herding goats or carrying firewood or riding a horse or something, you want to avoid the E, the short side of the hill, because that's the steepest side. Once you know that that exists, you see the landscape differently. So I never thought about the shape of hills, but once I learned that concept, I began to look at hills differently. So just knowing that word, that little package of information, affects the way you're interacting with the landscape. It affects your behavior. It is, in some ways, a survival technology.
Are linguists still finding new languages around the world?
They are. I mentioned before that there are approximately 7,000 languages that have been identified by science. I had the privilege of doing this in 2008 with my research team in India. We identified a language called Koro, that's K-O-R-O, spoken in a few remote villages up in the Himalayas. And this language had never been recognized by the political or social structures or by scientists. So it's a language that's completely new to science. And it's very exciting to be able to make the first recordings of this language. So I have a sound clip of a woman named Abamu Degio, and she's singing a traditional song in the Koro language.
Icharu o se londi me di go hungora lo ingo.
So you spend a lot of your time traveling around the world meeting people who speak these rare languages, right?
Yeah, it's a real privilege, and I've been doing this for 15 or more years. I get to meet people who, in many cases, have never traveled more than a few miles from the village where they were born on some remote island or perhaps up in the Himalayas or the Andes. They have an incredibly local existence, and yet they have an incredibly expansive worldview. And I'm always amazed at the knowledge that they have and that they're willing to share. I write about this in my book, The Last Speakers, The Quest to Save the World's Most Endangered Languages. These amazing individuals that I refer to as language warriors. Often they're elderly, but often I'm also meeting a younger generation who are doing very innovative things like performing hip-hop in their languages.
Who performs hip-hop?
Well, hip-hop is global, of course. And so I've been in communities in Chile, in India, in Micronesia, where people have borrowed the genre of hip-hop, but they're creating lyrics in the local languages. And so I have a recording of some young men speaking the Akha language, which is spoken in the Himalayas in India, and they're performing a hip-hop song in this language.
Asam pasam palapan chaina for futanya for me nya futanya gijirin piar in a hot jar. Asam kasam palapan chaina for futanya for me nya futanya gijirin piar in a hot jar.
It's a song about love and romance, and it uses the metaphor of hot chili peppers. That's about as much of a translation as I can give.
That's great. Now, you've also developed something that you've called talking dictionaries. Tell me about this.
Well, you know, we live in the internet age and we take it very much for granted. But most of the world's languages have no presence whatsoever in the internet. You can't find even a single word, much less a recording. And so I helped communities build something that I call talking dictionaries. You can visit talkingdictionary.org and see some of the more than 60 talking dictionaries we've created. For example, the Tsleil-Waututh language, which is a Native American language spoken in Oregon. It has one fluent speaker and a handful of people who are trying to learn it within the tribe. And the fluent speaker, his name is Bud Lane, he sat down and he recorded, I think, 12,000 words in the Tsleil-Waututh language.
It's fascinating. So you're talking about using new technology to try to preserve these sometimes very ancient languages.
Not only preserve them, but to revitalize and expand them. They do things like sending text messages in the language, and they have to invent new words for technology. So they have to decide, you know, are we going to borrow the word computer for English, or are we going to make up a new word in the Tsleil-Waututh language that means brain in a box? They tend to go for the latter solution. And so even with a minuscule number of speakers, you can have new intellectual things happening, like the invention of new words and concepts.
One of the things that's so wonderful to hear you talk about is, I mean, the optimism that you seem to have. I mean, you know, one way to read this whole story is it's, oh my God, you know, all these languages are going extinct, but there is a concerted effort, obviously, in some places to not only preserve them, but to revitalize them in some cases.
Indeed, we are in the middle of an extinction crisis, one that parallels and even exceeds the extinction crisis of plant and animal species. But there is a vibrant global movement for language revitalization, and it's exciting to see these communities around the world leveraging new technologies and making a renewed commitment to keep their languages. They realize in some cases they've been presented with the false choice that they have to give up their heritage language and only speak a global language like Spanish or English. And so people are realizing this and they're unwilling to give up their languages. And we should all be really happy that that is an emerging trend.
Speak my language.
David Harrison is a linguist at Swarthmore College. He co-directs the Enduring Voices Project at the National Geographic, and he's the co-star of the documentary film The Linguists. His most recent book is called The Last Speakers, The Quest to Save the World's Most Endangered Languages. Coming up, young Israeli hipsters rediscover Yiddish. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about saving the world's languages in this hour, and we're partnering with a radio show in another language. Israel Story is one of the most popular radio shows in Israel, now going into its second season. Some people call it the Israeli This American Life. Here, Israel Story journalist Dana Harman takes us to the epicenter of the rebirth of a dying language, a Yiddish library in Tel Aviv, in a rather unlikely location.
Past the vendors hawking cheap knapsacks, phone cards, bed sheets, plastic plants, and greasy falafels, up the ramp beyond the STD clinic and a kindergarten for African migrants' kids is a dark corridor with an open door. Welcome to Tel Aviv's massive and much maligned central bus station, the Tachana Merkazit HaChadasha. It's where hapless commuters shuffle along with foreign workers, refugee seekers, drug addicts, prostitutes, and homeless. And into this mix, add one Belgian-born Orthodox yeshiva boy turned Bohemian Israeli, a Yiddish performer and book collector. That's him, Mendy Kahan, who's speaking here in Yiddish. He's a 48-year-old bachelor with bushy eyebrows, sparkly blue eyes, and a receding mane of gray hair, who today is sitting at a desk amongst a clutter of papers and unpaid bills, chain-smoking rolled cigarettes. He looks for his lighter, and then he looks for his mobile phone, and then, thinking of an even better plan, he starts looking for his glasses so he can actually look for his mobile and his lighter. He then gets up and puts on an old tin kettle for mint tea, swaying ever so slightly back and forth as he chats, a leftover, perhaps, from his early Antwerp yeshiva days. Though you wouldn't know it from looking at him, Mendy's kind of a rock star in the Yiddish world.
I was born in Belgium. I grew up in Antwerp, which is like really like a cosmopolitan Jewish city. I grew up with Yiddish, with French, Dutch, and of course also Hebrew. You know, like at school we learned the Mishnah, the Talmud in Hebrew. Like it was a traditional religious society, but open-minded at the same time. Like we also went to the synagogue and we also saw movies. At home, I had books of Sartre and Camus of my mother, and we also had a good Jewish library with the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Marshur, the all kinds of exegesis.
In 1980, right after high school, he came to study at a yeshiva in Israel, but soon began straying from his Orthodox path, enrolling in secular courses at Jerusalem's Hebrew University.
From quite early on, I felt that I wanted to get out of the religious world, which felt to me like the small shtetl. Everyone knew each other. I wanted to be in the universal world. Israel was for me an encounter with freedom, with sunshine, with open skies. I went to Hebrew University.
On a whim, he decided to tack on a Yiddish literature class to his course load, just really for old time's sake. And that's when he realized something in Israel was amiss.
it was really like we were in the department. We were three or four students, like really a small department. And the feeling was that it's dying. And here we are studying at the university to keep the memory going. But actually, it's a dying thing. And this feeling that it's dying and that it has gone from the world and that it has not really much to say anymore, this was really disturbing. I lifted my eyes from the book and I said to myself, here we are in Israel, in our home country, finally. And where is all this? Like, where, how come there's no even a memory of it? And I understood that these are my roots and I have to do something with it. And so I said to myself, I'm young, I have ambition, I want to do something creative. And so let's take this Yiddish thing and let's take it a step further. Let's take it into life. Then I started to collect Yiddish books.
Mendy started collecting in 1996, putting out word that he would take care of any Yiddish book dropped off at his place in Jerusalem. He soon was overwhelmed by calls and then visits, typically from younger Israelis who couldn't speak Yiddish. They, following the death of an older relative, didn't know what to do with the books left behind. Many of these youngsters, Mendy told me, felt it would be pretty disrespectful to toss out their grandparents' or their parents' libraries. But they also didn't really want them there on their new IKEA shelves. Now they had a much better option, guilt-free. They could schlep them all over to Mendy's and leave them on the doorstep. The piles in his living room grew and grew and grew.
I didn't know what I was going into. Like, I thought I would collect a few hundreds, thousands of books. I would have a nice library and I will have good reading material.
Before World War II, there were some 15 million people in Eastern Europe who spoke and read Yiddish, a mix of German, Hebrew, and Aramaic written in Hebrew characters. That world was lost and destroyed in the Holocaust. But there's been something of a mini revival of interest in Yiddish language and literature. Here in Israel, there are about 500 high school students sitting for the Yiddish matriculation exams. There are more universities and colleges offering Yiddish literature as part of their courses. But still, outside of ultra-Orthodox circles, in Israel, Yiddish basically is a dead language. It never stood a chance, really. In pre-state Palestine, and then later in newborn Israel, Yiddish was seen by many as a competition to Hebrew, the ancient biblical language which had been revived by Eliezer ben Yehuda. And so Yiddish was not only neglected, it was actually derided. When we spoke to Avshalom Kor, Israel's go-to authority on the Hebrew language, he explained that the attitude was...
When you talk Yiddish, you are attached to the diaspora. Eliezer ben Yehuda, for instance, he was ready to talk to everybody in every language in the world. He knew many languages, but never Yiddish, because Yiddish is a concept that you do not belong to the land of Israel. You do not belong to the language of the Bible. Yehudi,
that's the anthem of the Hebrew Language Brigade, a group completely devoted to safeguarding Hebrew from foreign intruders, like Yiddish. Speak Hebrew, Jew, go the lyrics, because that's the language of your land and people.
There is a story about the riots of the years 36 until 39, riots against Jews in the Promised Land.
These riots are known today as the Arab Revolt. The Arab Revolt was a nationalist uprising by Palestinian Arabs against the British Mandate and the mass Jewish immigration.
A Jewish bus on its way. Arabs started shooting. One of the Jewish passengers shouted, Yorim aleinu, kulam nishkav. They're shooting at us. Everybody lying down. One of his friends stood up and said, Do shistmen, uneret ebreish. It was Yiddish. Here they are shooting. And he talks Hebrew. At the middle of the riots, in the Jewish bus, there was the battle between Hebrew and Yiddish.
And indeed, in the 1930s and 40s, in an era that celebrated the figure of the Tzabar, the strong, virile, tanned Israeli toiling away on the fields of the kibbutz, Yiddish was losing that battle big time. Yiddish movies were boycotted, kiosks selling Yiddish papers were attacked, and local Yiddish musicians were banned from performing. all those Yiddish books saved from Eastern Europe and lovingly brought to the new land of the Jews lay yellowing on dusty shelves. In a country that was trying to forget the Holocaust, they represented something weak, even shameful.
I remember this woman, when I met her, she was like beyond the 80s, and she told me how she came here to Israel, and with this whole feeling of wanting to give. She came from Vilna after the destruction and wanting to educate the children. And she says, and here I arrived, and the first thing that she saw is that she started to talk to the children in Yiddish, and they immediately, they were 3-4 years old, and they were putting their hands on their ears so they shouldn't hear, like they had this already inborn reaction to Yiddish. And this hurt her so much. She said, how did I know to close the ears? Like little children, innocent little children, how did I know this? And this pain, when she told me, was as if it was fresh and alive. And she told me, like, my husband, when he died, he told me, it cannot be that they will continue seeing Yiddish like this. They at some point it will change. And here you have arrived to take the books. And so I felt like a calling.
Soon, Mendy's little Jerusalem apartment was overflowing with donated books. And so he decided to make it all official and call it a library. Jung Yiddish.
Jung Yiddish. Jung means young in Yiddish. So it's to relate to the young energy, to the rejuvenating energy of Yiddish. Like if you have Ying and Yang, so you also should have Jung. At the beginning, it was really like hush-hush. People told it to each other from word of mouth. People came from Bnei Barak, cantors, yeshiva students, or people who like literature, who know to sing.
The center was thriving, but Mendy was a bit of Spielkes, as they say. And with the sunny beaches of the Mediterranean calling, he decided to get on Route 1 and head 45 minutes west to the big city of Tel Aviv. He set up shop temporarily in the basement of an office building, but when that space was taken over by a kindergarten a few years later, he found himself, together with, 20,000 books and counting, evicted and out on the street.
Yeah, when you're a refugee, you know, with books or with pekelech, you don't have much time to think. Every day is like survival, like Jewish survivors, not like the survival of television, you know.
Desperate, he followed a tip from friends of friends, which led him to the Behemoth bus station. There, as luck would have it, in something of an attempt to revive the reviled space, the city had begun offering cheap rents to encourage artists to move in.
So I saw this place. It was like a deserted parking lot with birds flying around and no windows and nothing, no electricity. I had like 7 tons of Yiddish books that I needed to find a house for. And so I said, that's it. That's the place.
He fixed the windows, he swept the floor, brought in some secondhand Persian rugs, and moved in with his hoard of Yiddish treasure. If you go to Mendy's Kingdom today, there are like 40,000 books there. It's amazing. Periodicals and magazines fill the cavernous space behind the office. They're lined up on shelves, they're propped up on the walls, they're piled high all over the ground. Health magazines from Warsaw circa 1924, joke books out of the 1930s Vilnius, and beautifully illustrated children's books from New York in the 1940s. There are novels by Shlomele Ettinger and Chaim Grada, poems by Manny Leib, there are plays by Yud Lamed Peretz, and translations of everything from Pushkin to Hemingway to Cervantes, all in Yiddish. Stop by, you won't be alone. On any given day, besides Mendy and the occasional volunteer cataloging books or organizing a temporary exhibition, you're as likely as not to find, maybe a few bearded chassids in the corner who've popped in for a schmooze, or a handful of Russian immigrants reading Der Tunkeler or looking up something in an Avram Raisin poem. There are occasional curious tourists who wander in, or shy students who don't know a shlemiel from a shlemazel, but who will show up with a letter from a grandparent they've found and need translated. And then there are the young hipsters, lounging around, having a smoke with Mendy.
Yiddish has become like a really a fringe culture. It does not have a home. doesn't have a nation, does not have an establishment. So many groups who also feel that they're not part of the establishment, they must, they're at the fringes of society, they connect with Yiddish. So be it lesbians or homosexuals or people who don't feel at home with this Hebrew militarism, they find Yiddish a more peaceful and a more lenient culture to connect to.
Several times a month, Yiddish fans of all sorts gather here for themed evenings, everything from sing-alongs to cabarets to Holocaust memorials to herring and kugel tastings. Mendy will typically get up on stage at some point, often with a visiting artist in tow. And with the always appreciative crowd swaying and humming along, he will begin to croon. This evening, he's invited his keyboard player, a small lady in her 70s, to center stage. She takes the microphone, flashes a sort of flirtatious smile, pushes back her gray hair, strikes a pose, and channels Edith Piaf. In Yiddish, of course. The crowd, to use a Yiddish word my mom taught me, quells. At the end of the evening, we sit around near the oversized cushions depicting the greats of Yiddish literature, Mendel and Mocher Tzvoirim, Shalom Aleichem and Yud Lamed Peretz, and we talk. Mendy pours out the mashke, the vodka, for a bissel l'chaim, he says, and rolls himself another cigarette. The buses rumble overhead, shaking the entire room, and a muffled announcement in Hebrew informs us that the 394 will soon be leaving for the city of Eilat. And then it's quiet for a moment, allowing my thoughts to wander. Those great Yiddish writers and thinkers who so yearned and dreamed the land of Israel, what would they make of this central bus station library? I ask Mendy, how would they feel about this place provided to them in their promised homeland?
Well, I don't know if they will dance from joy, because on the one hand, like, they come from, there were millions of readers around them, and here these books are a little bit left aside, a little bit hurt. But there's so many intelligent, bright things and so much work in this book, so much thoughts. If I would have some money, I would make panels so that you can see the writers, their biographies, and then you could see the richness of all this. But for the moment, this is the best we could do, so that's it. But I believe it will grow. It will.
Journalist Dana Harman of Israel Story brought us that piece. You'll hear more of our collaborations with them in coming months. Israel Story will launch an English language show in early September. You can find out more on our website at ttbook.org. And now, a trip to the not-so-distant future, where print is dying and words can vanish. Elena Graydon has written an intellectual thriller called The Word Exchange. It begins like this.
On a very cold and lonely Friday last November, my father disappeared from the dictionary, and not only from the big glass building on Broadway where its offices were housed. On that night, my father, Douglas Samuel Johnson, chief editor of the North American Dictionary of the English Language, slipped from the actual artifact he'd helped compose. That was before the dictionary died, letters expiring on the page. before the virus, before our language dissolved like so much melting snow.
Elena, your book starts with such an ingenious premise. Printed books have disappeared, language itself is endangered, and words have been monetized. Everyone now communicates with devices called memes, which are sort of like smartphones on steroids but networked into your brain?
Exactly. So the book is set a few years in the future. People have become even more dependent on their devices than, say, I am on my iPhone, and that's how they access language. And the meme really is sort of the next generation of the kind of devices that we all use now, and sort of similar in a lot of ways to the iPhone that I depend on so heavily myself. And it kind of anticipates our wants and needs using sophisticated algorithms. And also some users have gotten an optional microchip implanted in their brains, and that's what makes it possible, yeah, for language to be disrupted.
Well, so this is a futuristic noir thriller. So, of course, there is an evil corporation. And in this case, some tech moguls have figured out, as you said, how to monetize words. Explain, how does this work?
So because people have become even more dependent on these devices, they've actually sort of yielded more and more of the functionalities that we maybe once thought of as fundamental to our humanity, decision-making, creating and interpreting things, and even using language. And they've started to forget some kind of obscure words. Initially, they forget things that maybe they just don't use that regularly or don't come across, like paradox or cynical. But their device gives them the option to download the definition from this vast online database, which is called the Word Exchange, the same title of my book. And so for a small fee, I think 2 cents at the beginning of the book, they can get just the flash of a little definition and they can continue on with their conversation or reading their email or whatever it was that they were doing. And the developers of this device are in fact the same developers who own this vast database of language. And so they decided that maybe they would, you know, exploit that memory and language loss a little bit in this way.
This is such a brilliant, evil idea. It was a little scary to read. I mean, when you thought about corporations buying and then selling the rights to words, did you think, no way, that's too far-fetched? Or did you think, oh, yeah, that could happen?
Well, you know, I obviously, in many ways, this book is meant to be a little bit fantastical. And by setting it in the future, I was interested in maybe shining a bit of a light on the present. So now there are huge conglomerates that have consolidated holdings of lots of things, music, film, you know, judicial records, maybe things that we sort of didn't ever imagine being consolidated in those ways. And yet, you know, that's become a reality. And I was sort of interested in thinking about applying that process to language and looking at what might happen if, you know, an outside force were to determine for us what words we had access to, what information we had access to.
I'm curious, are you the kind of person who reads dictionaries for fun?
I do, yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of unusual words in my book, and partly the reason for that is that the characters are lexicographers, so they come across words that other people don't encounter. And then part of the reason for that is that over the course of the book, some of the characters catch this virus, which they refer to as word flu, and so their language actually devolves over the course of the book.
That is one of the scariest parts of the book, this language plague. Can you explain more about it?
Sure. So because the devices are hooked into people's physiology, it makes it possible for there to be a virus that in many ways mimics a computer virus, and it's referred to as word flu because it garbles people's speech and language.
Garbles it how?
They'll think of a word that is really not exactly the word that they intended to use, or they'll just sort of flip-flop letters within a word in a way that makes it really difficult for them to communicate.
And like a virus, it's...
Exactly. It's communicable.
Right. It's communicable, and also it's kind of seeding ordinary accepted language with these nonsense words that will appear.
Exactly.
So it gets harder and harder to tell what's a real word and what isn't.
you know, I wanted to use language as its own tool for demonstrating what the significance of its loss would be for us. And I wanted to sort of at least suggest the alienation that we might feel if we no longer had access to this incredible resource that only works because we all share in the work of learning it and maintaining it and, you know, letting it evolve together.
Well, so speaking of the connection between words and the physical body, I was wondering, I mean, we're talking on public radio, and a lot of people may not know you're also the daughter of a famous public radio couple, the hosts of People's Pharmacy. And I often think of radio as the most impermanent medium. I mean, at the end of the day, there's nothing I can point to and say physically and say, I made that. You know, it's sound waves and air. What do you think about the difference between written and spoken language?
That's such a wonderful question. One of the ideas that I was really interested in the book, and there's one character who's really interested in the philosopher Hegel, and he talks a lot about the ways, the real physicality of spoken language and the ways in which it's really a kinesthetic experience in some ways. I mean, there's the vibrations in the vocal cord of the speaker, these cords rubbing together that creates a sound that then travels through the air as waves and then enters into the body of their interlocutor and sort of rubs, oscillates their, you know, in their ear canal in just the right way.
Are you saying talking is really a kind of physical touching?
I think so. And certainly Hegel seemed to think so. And I think that's what makes sound and spoken language feel in some ways like such a more intimate experience. And I was really interested, too, in this idea that sound sort of disappears as it appears. It almost kind of there's an image in the book of Ouroboros, the sort of serpent eating its own tail. Mm-hmm. And sound is sort of just that way. It's this being that is also sort of almost non-being. It exists and then it sort of disappears all at the same time. And there's something so beautiful in that ephemerality.
Well, Elena, before I let you go, I was going to ask if you would give us one more reading. There's a little meditation, just a little short meditation about language that I love, and I wondered if you'd read it.
I would be honored.
That's called Exactitude and Evocation.
Okay, so this is taken from the journals of one of the characters, whose name is Bart, and he unfortunately later succumbs in the book to word flu, and he's writing in his book about some of the reasons that language is so important to him and why he wanted to devote his life to studying it, recording it, and making it possible for other people to access it. And this is one of the things that he writes in his journal about why he loves language. Language is infinite. It can be as creative and as chillingly precise as the human mind. Bombenbrand Schrumpfleischen, e.g. a word coined per conditions distinct to the 20th century, means incendiary bomb-shrunken bodies. Less distressing, in a sense, is shita, Farsi, leftover dinner that's eaten for breakfast, or the Indonesian jayas, to bungle a joke so badly that your interlocutor feels forced to laugh. In Japanese, koi no yoken means the ineluctable feeling you have upon meeting someone for the first time that eventually the two of you will fall in love. Words compress impressions into facts cold as frozen quarters. One single word, like emergency or love, can revise a whole night, a whole life.
Elena Graydon. Her new novel is called The Word Exchange.
Language, it's a virus.
That's it for our conversation about language, but we're not done talking. When we come back, Norway's breakout literary star, Karl Ove Knausgård, shares his playlist for his new book. And a father and daughter look back fondly on a trip that was not actually that much fun. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. And now it's time for Playlist, writers on the music that inspires their work.
I'm Karl-Ove Knausgård, the author of My Struggle, and I always listen to music when I write. I'm incapable of writing without music. And there is always one band or one album that kind of dominates the novel I'm writing, which I'm listening to all the time, and which is the novel for me. And when it comes to My Struggle, that's six novels, but one of the bands I listened to all the time was the American band Midlake, their album The Courage of Others. So when I go back and read My Struggle, that's the band I'm associated to. And the other way around, when I listen to Midlake, I'm just deep into the process of writing again. And I think I like it because it's so melancholy and it's so evocative, and they have some great tunes in there as well. I just love that band.
When all the newness of gold travels far from where it once been, born like the earth over years, and when the acts of men cause the ground not to wait. Great are the sounds of all that live and all that man can hold.
I'm playing the music while I'm writing, and in the beginning of a novel I play all kinds of music, and then something, you know, it's been pointed out. So in the end of the novel I play constantly on repeat one album. You want the same atmosphere, you want the same background of sounds, with the same mood when you are writing, at least I do. So I just disappear into writing with the music in my head. I think what I'm looking for is the mood in the music, you know? There are things that you can't grasp with your intellect, but it's just your feelings. And there's a lot of feelings in that melancholy Midlake album.
Ove Knausgård puts Midlake's album The Courage of Others on his playlist. The music inspired his six-volume series of autobiographical novels called My Struggle. And now it's time for On Our Minds. With school out, it's family vacation season, and there's nothing like a road trip for family bonding. Kids in the back seat, parents up front, nothing but endless miles and miles ahead. The truth is, family vacations are often at their best in retrospect. For instance, some years ago, Mark Jacobson and his wife took their three kids around the world. Mark and his daughter Ray have remarkably fond memories of things many families would find deeply disturbing, like their visit to the famous burning ghats of India, the funeral pyres.
A ghat just means steps. And there were these gigantic funeral pyres there and these big railroad-sized ties of wood with these bodies on them. And how you find the burning ghat is simple.
You just follow your nose.
You follow your nose, or you can follow, you'll see these, in India they have a lot of rickshaws, you know, bicycle, trishaw kind of things. And you'll see these dead bodies, like, you know, in the pedicab, wrapped up, like sort of almost like mummies. And they're just sort of sitting there as if they were alive, but they're dead. And you just follow one of those, and you'll get there. And then you go there, and you'll see, and there are dead bodies stacked up, getting ready to go. And all the relatives are there, and they have these deals that you negotiate with what they call the burning ghat wala. A wala is like a merchant.
Wasn't there a fight you saw when you
were
there?
Yeah, there was a fight. Well, what happens is he sets a price because the wood costs a lot of money. But if the body is not totally burned, or if you don't play the proper, what they call bakshish, which is like a bribe of a sort, then, you know, it's too bad. You know, the body's not totally burned. They just take the body and toss it half burned into the river. And my
it's
children.
Extremely heart wrenching to watch.
My children found this to be a little upsetting.
He was surprised by that, too. This is a people who wouldn't let us watch commercial TV. We're shocked that, you know, this would upset us in any manner.
Ray, none of us were kids. Ray, don't I remember that you and your brother and sister all turned to your dad and said, "Well, you pay. We have money."
Well, yeah, it was kind of like a, can't we please help, you know what I mean, please? Because, like, these people are, like, screaming and fighting, and I were sitting there thinking, like, God, if this was, like, you know, Mom or something, like, this is what she needed if we believed in something like this, like, it would just be awful. So it's like, obviously, you know, everybody's somebody's mother or daughter or son or somebody important to someone, so you gotta help where you can. But we didn't get a chance to.
We didn't react fast enough. They threw the body in the water while we were talking about what we were going to do about it.
Like under 2 minutes.
Did you and your wife debate at all about whether this was an appropriate thing to expose your children to?
Well, no. We went into it with this kind of like demented theory that anything that happened in the world would be okay for them to see. Of course, we didn't want to put them in any kind of danger or anything like that. But we felt that anything that people did that was basically a major portion of people's lives was okay for them to see.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that any qualms about that whatsoever. There was a lot of complaining going on, but we thought that that was fine, too.
Now, you also took your family to the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh in Cambodia. This is the place where the Khmer Rouge had tortured and killed some 20,000 people. What was that like?
It was incredibly upsetting, but worth seeing. Everybody should see that. I did a report on it when I was in high school, and no one in my class had heard of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You say the Holocaust and everybody knows, but this happened in the like, 70s, and no one paid any attention because it was during the Vietnam War, and they used Cambodia as like the delta there. They used it as like a jumping off point to get into Vietnam.
What was at the Genocide Museum? What do you see?
Nothing, really. It's like, I mean, the most upsetting part is probably there's a room. You pass through one room. It's pictures of people, you know, holding numbers like mugshots, kind of. And then the next room is just like case after case of skulls. And that really is kind of like something that screws you up, you know. But in general, it's like it used to be a high school. And then when the Khmer Rouge came in, they turned it into this sort of prison. And now it's a museum, you know what I mean? It's like kind of slow, but just knowing the history makes it way more creepy than you'd ever think. We were there for about 10 minutes and I started to cry.
Were you angry at your parents for taking you there, or were you
no,
glad
I
you'd
asked
gone?
To go. I asked to go to that particular place because I'd been interested in this. It seemed like something that needed to be seen. Like people go to the Holocaust Museum. You know what I mean? They visit Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if you know, it's good to see the worst of humanity so that you really get a better sense of what isn't worth complaining about. And also, you know, the greater picture and things to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think 20,000 people were killed in that one building. The fact that it's right in the middle of the town, Phnom Penh's actually a wonderful place. I like it anyhow. And it's just this building, which is, used to be, as Ray said, it used to be a school. And it's right in the middle of the town, so on the other side of the wall, you see people going about their normal business every day, you know, just riding around, selling stuff, and just being regular people. And they have all the pictures that Ray mentioned. The thing that's kind of interesting about them is every person, because the Khmer Rouge were like the Nazis in the sense that they're very good record keepers. And they recorded a picture of every single person that died in the place. And you look at all these faces, and you realize that each one of these people, they know they're about to die, and it's kind of overwhelming to think about that. And the fact that it's this place in this kind of prosaic setting, it stays with you. It's one of those things that stays with you.
Did you meet people in these places, too? People who lived there, or were you mostly just kind of traveling around looking at things?
We met a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, we did.
When we went to Angkor Wat, we met this guy who was kind of showing us around a little bit. And both of his parents had been killed by the Khmer Rouge. And his attitude about it was just so uplifting in a way. He had this theory about the world continually going on, you know, despite the fact of where he came from, what happened to him when he was a kid. Makes you feel, as Ray just said, it's like really makes you, give you an idea about what you want to complain about and what you don't want to complain about. And I think it was kind of like what we were hoping that would happen by going to this place, just that kind of osmosis of this larger universe.
Not everything about this trip was sad and dark, though. I mean, you did manage to have some fun. Mark, I was remembering a story you told about an encounter with a waiter in Cairo.
Well, yeah, that was kind of funny.
You got what you deserved.
When you travel around, you look for places that are kind of like feel okay to you. So since we're from New York and we're from Brooklyn and we're used to guys talking like this and all stuff like that, we got to Cairo, which is a big bustling city, which is not unlike New York City. But we got there late at night, and there was no place to eat except this one place where they have this stuff called koshery, which is like Egyptian fast food. They had a menu on the wall, which had a bunch of other stuff. So we went in there, and I said, I'd like to have this falafel and that. And he says, and the waiter is standing there looking very impatient. He's going, koshery and Pepsi. I said, no, yeah, that's nice, but I want to have this. You know, he says, and he just says, koshery and Pepsi. And I go like, yeah, but I want, you know, it says this, and that's what I want, you know.
Mind you, everybody else got that the waiter was saying that they had only kosher and Pepsi, except for my dad.
So I'm going like, I want a falafel and an orange soda. He says like, kosher and Pepsi. So finally, he looks at me and says, don't you understand English? Kosher and Pepsi. That's what we have. That's what we always have. We've never had anything else. It's the only thing we have. So. At that point, all the kids were, like, laughing at me because I'd been chumped by this waiter. So we thought, wow, this is a good place. We can live here because the people are like us.
Mark and Ray Jacobson, reminiscing about the family's 90-day trip around the world. Mark wrote about it in a book called 12,000 Miles in the Nick of Time. That's what's on our minds this week. We post new On Our Minds segments every day on our website. ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison by Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Raymond Tangakar. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
Everybody. PRI, Public Radio International.